Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Radio Jihad Network. This is The Elemental Struggle, and I'm Gary H. Johnson, Jr. I'll be your host this evening for about an hour or so. We're going to be doing a little bit of a news hour today, so if you're interested in talking about what's going on in the world, if you're interested in gabbing a little bit, give me a holler. Go ahead and Skype in or give me a phone call. Today we're looking at a number of things. I've been focused on the Libya situation over at Family Security Matters for some time, and I've just put out a new release. As you can see on there, there is a third front in the battle in Libya. Most people talk about the fact that towns have been switching hands back and forth between Ajdabiya and Brega and in the east, and focused on the coastal areas. They've been looking at Misrata and seeing what's going on there. But there is another area, and that area is a mountain region about 100 miles south or so from Tripoli. And this region has been under attack and under siege for roughly about 4 to 6 weeks in various degrees. And tomorrow I'm going to be releasing a paper on the subject at Family Security Matters. So if you have a chance, please go over to Family Security Matters tomorrow morning and check it out. I'm going to try to send it over to the Tea Party Tribune as well, see if I can't post it there. But it's an amazing thing. The Berbers of the region have been in the fight with the Benghazi rebels since February 20th, since they started to realize that Muammar Gaddafi was killing his own citizens. They took their cue to start the process of mounting a revolution. And the mountainous regions were apparently very strategic as far as the Gaddafi regime is concerned, possibly for its ability to utilize caves to hide different chemical weapons and things of that nature. Who knows? But the rebels of the city of Zintan and another city called Nalut have been fighting in this small little mountain region. And the name of the mountain range, I mean, most people don't even realize that there is a mountain range in Libya, but the name of the mountain range is the Nafusa Mountain Range, and you can spell it N-A-F-U-S-A or N-A-F-O-U-S-S-A, sort of like Musa Kusa. The name, it's pretty much interchangeable. But what we're watching there is pretty amazing. You actually have the ability to see how the shift over from the American-led program to the NATO-led program has gone slowly but surely to the process of hitting Gaddafi tanks and Gaddafi armor in rural areas instead of urban areas like Misrata. See, in Misrata, you have a number of tanks and Grad rocket launching trucks and cars. And they're in the middle of a city, so the NATO regime, whose mandate is to protect civilians, can't by any means fire inside the cities without perfect intelligence and without precision striking ability. At the same time, the rebels are sending over information to NATO, and it takes about 8 hours for the information to be good, so they don't act on it because they figure by then a couple civilians have gotten in the way. So now in Misrata, you have a humanitarian crisis, which has come to a head over the course of the last weeks, in which upwards of 1,000 people have been killed, upwards of 1,000 civilians have been killed by indiscriminate rocket barrages. Possible cluster munitions have been used. Snipers have been randomly shooting people on the street. If it moves, they shoot it. UNICEF has just released a report in which at least 20 children have been killed in Misrata. Today, Press TV over in Iran actually talked about the fact that a journalist was killed in Misrata today. The interesting thing is Misrata is where the battle is going to come to a head as far as the international community is concerned. We have right now a number of elements going on, and one of the best ways to do it is just to flip over to the Voice of America. This is just in for the Voice of America. It's an April 20th report. It's called Libyan Rebels Get Military Advice from EU and Aid from the United States. Two more European Union countries say they will join Britain in sending military advisors to Libya to help rebel forces. Italian Defense Minister Ignazio La Russa said on Wednesday that his country will send 10 instructors to help train the rebels who are battling forces loyal to Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. Earlier Wednesday, France also announced that it will send military advisors for the Libyan rebels. Separately, U.S. officials say President Barack Obama's administration plans to give the Libyan opposition $25 million in non-lethal assistance. The officials say the assistance could include items such as vehicles, fuel trucks, protective vests, and non-secure radios. Meanwhile, French President Nicolas Sarkozy met in Paris with the head of the rebels' transitional council, Mustafa Abdel Jalil. After the meeting, Jalil told reporters that he invited Sarkozy to visit the rebel stronghold, the eastern city of Benghazi. Britain announced plans on Tuesday to send about a dozen military advisors to Libya to help rebels work on organization, logistics, and communications. The UN's human rights chief is warning the Libyan government that it may be committing war crimes by using weapons against civilians and medical facilities in the besieged city. In a Wednesday statement, High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay urged the government to halt the siege on the city. Libya's Foreign Minister Abdulati Al-Obeidi criticized the dispatch of foreign military advisors, saying it will harm chances for peace in the country. In an interview with BBC, Obeidi called for a ceasefire followed by a six-month period to prepare for an election. Fighting continued Wednesday between rebel and pro-government forces at the besieged western city of Misrata, where residents are pleading for international intervention. NATO airstrikes again struck government installations in several cities. Leaders in rebel-held Misrata called for the urgent intervention of foreign ground troops to protect the 500,000 civilians there, the first such request by anyone among Libya's opposition forces. The rebel civilian leadership, the Transitional National Council, has, however, rejected the presence of foreign troops on Libyan soil to help their cause. So as you can see from this One Voice of America article, there's a number of things going on. Italy's going to be sending in advisors. France is going to be sending in advisors. And Britain's announced that they were sending in advisors yesterday. This is a huge test. The UN has made a deal with the Gaddafi regime. And that deal is for the World Food Program to administer 50,000 tons of food around the Gaddafi regime's strongholds in areas from Tripoli all the way down to Saba that it controls, in order to guarantee that a corridor of assistance, humanitarian relief assistance, can reach the city of Misrata that's been under siege. Now, this deal was made in order to alleviate some of the pressure that's going on in Misrata. About 5,000 civilians, foreign nationals, are trying to get out and trying to escape. They've already evacuated about 1,000 of them from the ports, and about 5,000 more are waiting to get out, most of them from Ghana. You even have Iraqi civilians who were pushed out of Iraq in the violence there and are now in the process of being pushed out of Misrata. So there's a number of things going on there. But the most devastating part of it is the fact that the UN was willing to negotiate terms for the insertion of aid. They asked if it was okay to have a military escort for the process on the ground. And the Libyan government, the regime of Gaddafi, said, oh, absolutely not. You know, if y'all bring in any type of foreign troops, we're going to attack. That's just all there is to it. Now, this while they're saying there aren't any attacks going on whatsoever in Misrata. There's no attacks going on in Misrata. All we're doing is trying our best to get rid of this Al-Qaeda element, this crazy gang element that's trying to rise up against us. We're not doing anything out of the ordinary. You know, I mean, sure, we're carpet bombing the whole city, and we're randomly firing tank shells, sending in brigades of snipers to make sure that everybody's life there is hell. But we're not doing anything to the civilians there, no. Sure, 20 children have died, but I mean, there's really no proof of us using carpet bombing or anything like that. So in the process of establishing a corridor of humanitarian relief, the UN was willing to negotiate with this irrational player. And in the process, they have set the terms of the engagement. If any military boots hit the ground, at that point, the Gaddafi regime has already indicated that it is willing to go to guns against that invading force. And at the same time, Britain said, we're going to send about a dozen to 20 advisors. They're going to be colonels and majors from our military. In all probability, you know, they're going to be able to help some logistical training and things of that nature. And then on top of that, Italy and now France have come in and said, yeah, we're going to do the same thing. Yeah, they're military boots on the ground, sure. But we're going to tread carefully here and see if Gaddafi's really got any bite to his bark. Now, the interesting thing about this is that for the last week or so, a group called BRICS, has been opposed to the intervention going on in Misrata and the activities of the coalition who are creating this no-fly zone over Libya. This group, there's another article on the 14th from Voice of America. It says BRICS nations oppose use of force in Libya. It's by a lady named Stephanie Ho out of Beijing. And it states, the five BRICS nations have voiced their opposition to the use of force in Libya at a summit in the southern Chinese resort city Sanya. Meanwhile, leaders from the five large developing nations criticized the current dollar-dominated world monetary order and called for a broad-based international reserve currency system. Leaders of the BRICS countries, five of the world's major emerging powers, issued a joint declaration Thursday urging a peaceful resolution to the crisis in Libya. Chinese President Hu Jintao, who chaired the meeting, told summit participants of his country's concerns. Hu says recent months have seen political riots and even a war in North African countries negatively affecting regional stability. Four members of the BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, abstained on the vote on the United Nations Security Council resolution that authorized international enforcement of a no-fly zone over Libya. South Africa, which is joining the BRICS meeting for the first time, voted in favor of the UN resolution, but joined in Thursday's criticism of the Western-led air campaign in Libya. Another major issue was the BRICS countries' common goal of achieving a greater say in international institutions. President Hu says the leaders agreed that the rise of new power centers around the world is affecting the global economy. Hu says the changes in the world economy are complicated, and that increased international dialogue will be needed to reform and perfect global economic governance. The BRICS countries are calling for a broad-based international reserve currency system, which the declaration says would provide stability and certainty. Under the current global monetary order, the U.S. dollar is the leading reserve currency. The leaders are also welcoming discussions about the global role of the International Money Fund, an in-house accounting unit known as a special drawing right. Some analysts have said they believe the SDR could become a partial substitute for the dollar. The leaders also called the comprehensive reform of the United Nations and its Security Council. Their declaration said the Council should be more effective, efficient, and representative. The five BRICS countries make up nearly a fifth of the world's gross domestic product and include two of the most populous countries in the world. The leaders agreed to hold their fourth summit next year in India. Russia and Brazil already have posted past meetings. So here we have the United States in support of Britain, France, and Italy working to establish a no-fly zone that the countries that pretty much abstained, except for Germany, are saying, hey, you know, this is going way beyond the pale. You're not enforcing a no-fly zone here. You're giving support to the rebels. You're not creating an even playing field here, because if you were, Gaddafi would crush the rebels. I mean, that's just the nature of it. So the Russian-led program and the Chinese-led program at this point are actually searching for ways to make sure Muammar Gaddafi stays in power. So now the UN and its membership is now split. Instead of abstaining, now the BRICS countries are willing to say, no, this is not worth doing anymore. So we have the United States lead, the President Obama. You have President Sarkozy and Prime Minister Cameron on the 14th releasing an article, an op-ed, stating, you know, it's just unconscionable. It's unthinkable that any type of future government in Libya could have any sort of Gaddafi representation in it. It's just, I mean, he's been killing his own citizens. We've proven it. It's obvious. But in order to have any type of intervention at this point through the UN Security Council, you would have to have a new resolution beyond 1973, which included boots on the ground. But while in 1973 there were four or five abstentions, in this case, any type of future Security Council resolution would have one or two vetoes. So now we're in a situation to where the only way the Libyan rebels can survive is through direct unilateral intervention from Britain, the United States, or France. And the United States is planning to send $25 million in non-military aid. Somehow I don't have much hope for the rebels on this one. Now, a number of stories came out recently probably the best one that came out last week was a story in the Wall Street Journal. And that was called Rebels Hijack Gaddafi's Phone Network. It's by Margaret Coker and Charles Levinson. Now, in this article, what they do is they show how the Gaddafi regime had full control of the internet network and the cell phone network and pretty much had created a blackout for anybody who wanted to do any type of communications. Or in the best case scenario, if communications were established, they would be able to monitor every single phone call. So a team led by a Libyan-American telecom executive has helped rebels hijack Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's cell phone network and reestablish their own communications. The new network, first plotted on an airplane napkin and assembled with the help of oil-rich Arab nations, is giving more than 2 million Libyans their first connections to each other and the outside world after Colonel Gaddafi cut off their telephone and internet service about a month ago. That March cutoff had rebels waving flags to communicate on the battlefield. The new cell phone network, opened on April 2nd, has become the opposition's main tool for communicating to the front lines in the east and up the chain of command to rebel brass hundreds of miles away. While cell phones haven't given rebel fighters the military strength to decisively drive Colonel Gaddafi from power, the network has enabled rebel leaders to more easily make the calls needed to rally international backing, source weapons, and strategize with their envoys abroad. To make that possible, engineers hived off of part of the Libyana cell phone network, owned and operated by the Tripoli-based Libyan General Telecommunications Authority, which is run by Colonel Gaddafi's eldest son, and rewired it to run independently of the regime's control. Government spokesman Musa Ibrahim, asked about the rebel cell phone network, said he hadn't heard of it. Osama Abu Shagur, a 31-year-old Libyan telecom executive raised in Huntsville, Alabama, masterminded the operation from his home in Abu Dhabi. Mr. Abu Shagur and two children and two childhood friends, working as corporate managers in Dubai and Doha, started fundraising on February 17th to support the political protests that were emerging in Libya. By February 23rd, when fighting had erupted, his team delivered the first of multiple humanitarian aid convoys to eastern Libya. But while in Libya, they found their cell phones and Thuraya satellite phones jammed or out of commission, making planning and logistics challenging. Security was also an issue. Colonel Gaddafi had built his telecommunications infrastructure to fan out from Tripoli, routing all calls through the capital and giving him and his intelligence agents full control over phones and internet. On March 6th, during a flight back to the United Arab Emirates after organizing a naval convoy to the embattled city of Misrata, Mr. Abu Shagur says he drew up a diagram on the back of a napkin for a plan to infiltrate Libyana, pirate the signal, and carve out a network free of Tripoli's control. What followed was a race against time to solve the technical, engineering, and legal challenges before the nascent rebel-led governing authority was crushed under the weight of Colonel Gaddafi's better-equipped forces. After a week of victories, in which the rebels swept westward from Benghazi toward Colonel Gaddafi's home of Sirte, the rebel advance stalled and reversed on March 17, when the United Nations approved a no-fly zone and government forces kicked off a fierce counterattack. In a sign of deepening ties between Arab governments and the Benghazi-based administration, the UAE and Qatar provided diplomatic support and helped buy the several million dollars of telecommunications equipment needed in Benghazi, according to members of the Libyan Transitional Authority and people familiar with the situation. Meanwhile, rebel military commanders were using flags to signal their troops, a throwback that proved disastrous to their attempts at holding their front lines. "We went to fight with flags. Yellow meant retreat. Green meant advance," said General Ahmed al-Ghatrani, a rebel commander in Benghazi. "Gaddafi forced us back to the Stone Age." Renewed signal jamming also meant that rebel leaders and residents in Benghazi had little warning of the government forces' offensives across East Libya and the March 19 attempted invasion of Benghazi, which sparked panicked civilian evacuations of the city. Mr. Abushagor watched the government advances with alarm. His secret cell phone operation had also run into steep problems. The Chinese company Huawei Technologies Limited, one of the original contractors for Ljubljana's cellular network backbone, refused to sell equipment for the rebel project, causing Mr. Abushagor and his engineer buddies to scramble to find a hybrid technical solution to match other companies' hardware with the existing Libyan network. Huawei declined to comment on its customers or work in Libya. The Libyan expats in the project asked that their corporate affiliations be kept confidential so that their political activities don't interfere with their work responsibilities. Without Huawei, the backing from the Persian Gulf nations became essential. Otherwise, it is unlikely that the international telecom vendors would have sold the sophisticated machinery to an unrecognized rebel government or individual businessman. The Emirates government and its telecommunications company, Etisalat, helped us by providing the equipment we needed to operate Ljubljana at full capacity, said Faisal Al-Safi, a Benghazi official who oversees transportation and communications issues. UAE and Qatar officials didn't respond to requests for comment. Emirates Telecommunications Corp., known as Etisalat, declined to comment as well. Now, the story goes on, and it's definitely worth reading. Anybody who has a chance to read about this new network called Free Ljubljana and has a chance to recognize what went into it, it is amazing. It's an amazing, heroic story. This guy, this gentleman, Mr. Abushagor, he is a hero. He's an expatriate Libyan. And he came in and brought a few things together that no one else would after establishing a convoy to Misrata to help some relief there. Okay, now, let's see here. Another story that caught my attention today was from Press TV, and it's about the Iranian nuclear program. Y'all excuse me for just one moment. Allergies are still kicking over here in Georgia. And the article from Press TV is called No Deviation in Iran Nuclear Program. And it goes, based on reports released by the International Atomic Agency, there have been no deviations in Iran's peaceful nuclear program, Lara Johnny was quoted by Fars News Agency as saying on Wednesday. Iran's parliamentary speaker, Ali Larijani, made the remarks in a meeting with visiting deputy head of the Standing Committee of the National People's Congress, Chen Jili, in Tehran. Iranian speakers stressed the importance of recent regional developments and said the Islamic Republic of Iran welcomes China's constructive role in the region and international community. Jili arrived in Tehran on Sunday at the invitation of the Iranian Majlis, and met with Deputy Speaker of Iran's Parliament, Majlis Sayed Shahabuddin Sadr, on Monday. The two senior lawmakers called for promotion of parliamentary cooperation between the Islamic Republic and China. The Chinese legislator also met with the Iran-China Parliamentary Friendship Group Director, Hossein Sobhaniya, during her visit. So now with this situation going on in Libya, and nobody paying attention, and even with a number of sanctions on the Iranian regime still at play, China, who is against the United States in Libya and is a part of this BRICS program, who is rising up to pretty much provide Muammar Gaddafi a way out of the problem, is starting the process of working with Iran. Now, on more of an American side of things, while all this is going on, we still have wars going on in Iraq. We still have wars going on in Afghanistan. And Dawn today came out with a story. Actually, it's from Reuters, but it was ran in Dawn first, I do believe. And it's called Pakistan's ISI Links with the Haqqani Militants. And this is a story about Admiral Mullen, and he went over today to talk to the leadership in Pakistan and pretty much put it on the line with them. It states, the top U.S. military officer, Admiral Mike Mullen, accused Pakistan's intelligence agency of maintaining ties to militants in Afghanistan during a trip to Islamabad on Wednesday that was focused on easing diplomatic tensions. Well, I don't know if, you know, accusing somebody of working with terrorists is going to ease diplomatic tensions, but this is the tact he chose. This is our Joint Chief of Staff. Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said Pakistan's perceived foot dragging and tackling strongholds in North Waziristan, belonging to the Haqqani network, and its continuing relationship with it was the most difficult part of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. It's fairly well known that the ISI has a long-standing relationship with the Haqqani network, he said in an interview with Pakistan's Daily Dawn newspaper. Haqqani is supporting, funding, training fighters that are killing Americans and killing coalition partners in Afghanistan. And I have a sacred obligation, Mike Mullen said, to do all I can to make sure that doesn't happen. So that's at the core. It's not the only thing, but that's at the core that I think is the most difficult part of the relationship, Mullen said. Pakistan's powerful ISI directorate has long since been suspected of maintaining ties to the Haqqani network, cultivated during the 1980s when Jalaluddin Haqqani was a feared battlefield commander against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. I don't know what kind of relationship he's talking about, a senior Pakistani intelligence officer told Reuters. If he means we're providing them with protection, with help, well, that's not correct. But even if you're enemies, you do have a relationship. The Pakistani intelligence official said that Pakistan had attacked Haqqani's positions and raided his mosques in the past. Right now, though, we are not attacking him because we are fully engaged against another group, the Tariqi Taliban of Pakistan, known by the moniker TTP. Pakistan had been criticized in the past for distinguishing between good Taliban militants and bad ones, with the Haqqani network falling squarely into the former category. While based in Pakistan's wild North Waziristan area on the Afghan border, Haqqani refrains from attacking the Pakistan state and is seen as a way to maintain Pakistani influence in any future political settlement in Kabul, Afghanistan. The TTP, on the other hand, is a declared enemy of the Pakistani state and has been at war with it and its army since 2007. Before the trip to Pakistan, Mullen acknowledged that we've had a very turbulent time, but added that despite the tensions, all sides acknowledged the relationship was vital. I think that all of us believe that we cannot afford to let this relationship come apart, Mullen said, referring to the U.S. and Pakistan military intelligence chiefs. It's just too dangerous. It's too dangerous in each country, for each country. It's too dangerous for the region. He acknowledged that the relationship was difficult, but added, we walk away from it at our own peril, quite frankly. So here we have the BRICS nations dividing off and guaranteeing that Libya will remain a stalemate, forcing Britain's hand and France's hand and Italy's hand and providing military advisors to the Libyan rebels, which means that military boots will be on the ground in Libya. All because now we have to look for a situation to where any type of unilateral action can be provoked. Because we know for a fact that the BRICS nations will veto any type of enhanced UNSCR program that upgrades 1973 to boots on the ground. In the process, China has said, to hell with the UN, to hell with sanctions, we're going to start working with Iran. Admiral Mullen, after 2 years of working to establish a partnership with the Pakistani state, in which our counterinsurgency strategy gone in and started to work with the Pakistanis to push the Taliban from the Pakistan side and kind of squeeze them on the AFPAC border. After all of this, after $1.5 billion a year was approved by Congress for Pakistan, Admiral Mullen goes in and says, you know what, we think that y'all are working with the ISI. I mean, everything else is great, but we really think that the ISI is working with the Haqqani network. And, you know, that's kind of troubling to us, considering that's our, you know, avowed enemy. So that was pretty much a scuttle of the Pakistani relationship right there. There are a world of failures on the foreign relations front and the foreign policy front that are visible from the Obama administration at this point. And I'm going to go over to the switchboard real quick and see if anybody's paying attention out there. See all who all is around. Excuse me for my sinus problems today. All right. Okay, where are we at? Oh, we got Adrian in the chat room. It's good to see you, Adrian. We got Holger, Liberty Sun, and Reese Cup. Reese. It's good to see you, baby. We got Tommy Hunt, and welcome to y'all, guest. How's everything sounding today? I got a new mic today. I don't know if I'm close enough to it. I don't know if I'm, you know, rocking off the charts, if y'all are hearing all sorts of reverb. How's everything sounding out there, guys? Yeah, looks like Okay. Guys, feel free to call in. I'm going to be paying attention to the switchboard for just a second. I'm also going to take a quick break. So if you'll hold on with just one moment.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, sorry about that, guys. Had to make a few adjustments over here. Well, Tommy, that's a pretty good question. What the heck are we doing in Libya? That's a great one. Well, Tommy, I'll tell you what, man. Over the course of the beginning of the year, we started to realize that Gaddafi was starting to butcher his own people. Dozens at a time at first, whenever they were just protesting peacefully. And they said, look, you know, you've had power for 42 years. Take a step down. Let us create a new system. Let us create a system to where, you know, we won't have a dictatorship anymore. We'll have relatively representative government. In the process, since Gaddafi said no very loudly with multiple bullets, we started to see similar traits as Saddam Hussein, when Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurdish rebels for demanding their own sovereignty. So since we started to see a dictator butchering his citizens, and we started witnessing hundreds of disappearances at a time, there were tales of hospitals where people would go to a hospital after being fired upon by snipers, where they weren't killed, but then they would just disappear. People wouldn't go to government hospitals, and they ended up going to private ones, and then the Gaddafi regime would bomb those. He started using aircraft to bomb his own citizens around the country. We really didn't have much of a way to go on this one, except to say, you know what, this guy is Looney Tune baby, and we've got to do something about it. Now, if Bush was at the helm, or I think even if John McCain was at the helm, you know, any Republican worth his salt at all would have immediately gone in and forced a change of the regime, and we would have witnessed a very, very short ouster in which the United States boots on the ground would have gone in and in less than about 2 or 3 days would have wreaked havoc on everything Muammar Gaddafi, and we would have had him in chains and probably had him, you know, a rope around his neck in very short order. But instead, we have a president, the Obama administration, and that president's policies have forced an internationalization of our policies of foreign aid and foreign activity to where we're beefing up all of the institutions around the world. So global institutions like the United Nations and the International Criminal Court need help to make sure that we can, in the future, isolate regimes who have bad behavior, because everything is about changing the behavior of bad regimes. That's all negotiations are. That's all engagement is, right? So since we're trying to change bad behavior of the regimes around the world who are constantly murdering and butchering their own citizens, like in Sudan, like in Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, pretty much most of the Arab nations in Africa, you know, we are slowly but surely supposedly beefing up these institutions so that in the future these evil dictators will take pause before they decide to unleash their military apparatus against their own people. That's the purpose. That's why Obama said, we're going to get this one right. But in the process, the Obama administration gave no help whatsoever to Hillary Clinton, who was the man on point. And she engineered the passage of UNSCR 1970, which created a sanctions regime and made sure that an arms embargo was in effect over Libya, and pretty much cornered Muammar Gaddafi and forced him to use all the gold and money that he had stuffed in his mattresses. So it was going to be hard for him to pay anybody on his payroll at that point. Instead of relenting, instead of feeling isolated and cowed and thoroughly saddened by this horrible abuse from the international community because of his bad behavior, Muammar Gaddafi said, oh, you're not going to go to war with me? You're not going to invade me? In that case, I'll just start killing everyone who is trying to stand against me. Everybody who's saying that they're going to have this transition government and this parliamentary system, we're just going to make those people disappear. And in the process, over the course of about 2 weeks, the Muammar Gaddafi regime organized its forces and created a plan, and that plan was aimed at doing one thing: knocking out the rebel headquarters in Benghazi. Now, the rebel headquarters in Benghazi was important because over the course of time, from March 24th through April 6th, a sense of legitimacy had fallen upon this transitional government, this Libyan Transition Council, this National Transition Council, National Libyan Council, however you want to say it. And this legitimacy, this concept of legitimacy, is what is driving the nations in the Arab Spring. If you want to be a force to be reckoned with, if you want to rise to a position of leadership, you have to be recognized by the international community as a group who can do standard caretaker government activities while transitioning to a parliamentary or democratic system of rights. So the Libyan Transition Council began the process of sending out representatives to the international community, doing their best to catch people's attention and say, hey, we're here. We're the ones who truly represent the Libyan people. The problem is, in Tripoli and in Tripolitania, Muammar Gaddafi has an iron fist, and he has closed it, and everybody's scared for their lives, so they're not coming out with the signs that say Free Libya like we did, and we are still over in Tobruk and Ajdabiya. and Benghazi, and still are in the mountains, in Zintan, in Nalut. So because of this sense of legitimacy descending on the rebel leadership in Benghazi and their courthouse, Muammar Gaddafi decided that he was going to strike at the heart of Benghazi and knock out the only legitimate source of power that could replace him. That's why it's important for you to pay attention to the fact that all of the leaders out there in the international community are constantly saying Muammar Gaddafi has lost all legitimacy to lead, all sense of legitimacy, every single bit of legitimacy he has to lead, he has lost. But that's not what the Russians and the Chinese are saying right now. That's not what the Indians are saying right now. Instead, they're saying, hey, we need a ceasefire. We need a political solution. We need to figure this out. So before Operation Odyssey Dawn touched off, Muammar Gaddafi drove back the rebels to the city and gates of Benghazi, and he drove rebels into the streets of Misrata and back to the ports of Misrata and up into the mountains to the south and southwest of Tripoli. So there are about three redoubts where the rebels were. The problem was there were a number of those areas where oil and the oil ports were in control by the rebel forces. So the rebels had to figure out who was really, you know, giving them any sort of legitimacy. And at this point, France stepped to the plate and said, hey, Nicolas Sarkozy came out and said, hey, we think that you're the only, you know, true representatives of the Libyan people. Because they had already been saying over and over and over for weeks that Muammar Gaddafi lost all legitimacy. So even his son and anything about the Gaddafi regime was no longer possible. Now, when you're looking at that, then you have to look and say, who jumped on board with them? Now, on the night before Operation Odyssey Dawn started, Qatar jumped on board, and so did Italy. Qatar jumped on board and said, hey, you know, we're gonna help y'all out here, rebels. Go ahead and send us a few tankers full of oil, and we'll pay you for them, and we'll put it in a little account for you. And then you can make a few phone calls, you know, get the word out and say, hey, we're helping you build this pirate network right now as far as cell phones. We'll make sure that you can contact people over in Jordan and Egypt and people around the international community. And maybe you can get some more weapons sent to you. How about that? Italy wasn't too worried about it. I mean, 80% of their oil, I think, comes from Libya. So they were just looking at it and said, hey, you know, we're not too happy with the Muammar Gaddafi regime right now. I mean, it's caused a mass exodus to our island of Lampedusa. We're tired of this Arab Spring thing. We just want some oil. We want to make sure our cars run and everything's stable here and hunky-dory. So at that point, they made a deal with the rebels and said, as long as y'all keep bringing us oil and gas, we're going to be cool with you. So three states have recognized the rebels, and that's it. The United States stopped short. Britain stopped short. Germany never even bothered to try. Russia, China, nah. Brazil, nah. So out of the entire world community of 192 nations, three have recognized the rebels. So when we launched Operation Odyssey Dawn and led the proceedings, the reason we did was because we had the best technology. I mean, let's face it, we're the number one military power in the world. We said, hey, we can knock out the Russian guided missiles, no problem. All these mid-range missiles and all of the artillery and hangars of the Gaddafi regime, we can knock those out. And in the process of about 2 weeks, they knocked out all of the air defenses and established a no-fly zone. And to make sure that there was a no-fly zone that was actively working to secure the civilian population and make sure their security was manifest, at that point, the United States and its allies and the coalition of about 20 nations in what's called a contact group, they got together and started the process of bombing the ever-living hell out of everything Gaddafi armor. Every now and again, they would shoot up one of their own columns, of the rebel columns. Oops, sorry. I think we did that twice. But we knocked out about 30% of the capacity of the Muammar Gaddafi regime's ability to wage any type of war. And when I say that, that means they had roughly, I think, 2,000 tanks whenever this thing started, when this thing kicked off, and they're down to about 1,400, 1,200 now. They have a bunch of Grad rockets. They have a bunch of carpet bombs and cluster bombs and cluster munitions that they bought from Britain and the United States, no doubt. Maybe even Israel. Who knows? So there's a number of things in their arsenal. But the reason that we're there and still there, if you want to call it that, is because we are now in a logistical mode. On April 1st, the United States transitioned to a NATO lead. And while that doesn't mean much, you know, I mean, most people look at it and say, well, NATO is pretty much supplied by the United States, pretty much led by the United States. Well, what that did was it gave the international community, the international institution of NATO, a chance to be beefed up. A Canadian general took the helm instead of an American general. But interestingly, we dropped off the A-10s, the A-10 Warthogs, both the Marine and the Air Force versions, and the AC-130 Spectres, which pretty much obliterated any type of armored weaponry whatsoever and could operate in very tight areas since they were minigun-driven instead of missile-driven. So we now have a situation where NATO is in the lead, and they're asking for more planes with precision technology as far as their bombing is concerned. And all we're doing is providing logistics. We're just making sure everybody's getting to where they need to be. We are, as Obama said in his ultimatum speech, providing the political space necessary to make sure everybody is in the right formula for success on this one. So that's where we are. You know, it's a dicey situation, but in the process, we've created a stalemate in which the Muammar Gaddafi regime has the ability, since they have about a 10 to maybe 12 to 1 advantage as far as ground forces are concerned, not to mention what it can bring in from Algeria and Chad in mercenary form. We've established a stalemate in which the rebel camp, the opposition forces, don't really have a chance without more powerful weaponry or more advice or an intervention with U.S., British, or maybe even a UNIFIL peacekeeping force, boots on the ground mechanism. Some way to make sure that the genocide and mass murder of this serial mass murder, Muammar Gaddafi, doesn't continue. Now, I hope that makes sense. I know I went off a little bit. I'm going to go ahead and see what's going on in the chat room. Hello, you're on the air. Who am I talking with today?
This is Benjamin Solomon anyway. This is pretty interesting analysis about Libya. But here is the thing. I wonder, what do you think about our retired-in-chief Obama supporting the Muslim Brotherhood uprising in Egypt anyway?
Well, it's a little bit of a complicated picture as far as the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood is concerned. It's obvious that they were a problem, and the Obama administration has been on a U.S. Muslim engagement kick for a long time, and they've decided that all parties, whether religious or not, have the right to political representation in any type of uprising or any type of movement towards reform in those countries in the Arab Spring. So they took a position that guaranteed that we would have a problem with the Muslim Brotherhood. In the name of democracy, they guaranteed a war with Israel. That's what I think.
Exactly. I have to agree with you. Because here's the thing. The Muslim Brotherhood is trying to get the whole pie, but we have this stupid circus around which is cheering that Mubarak is gone. That's the thing. We have all these... I think that the left, including Obama, are cheering that Mubarak is gone and that the... they're cheering that the Egyptian uprising is happening, that Mubarak is gone. It's because They see a Mubarak as an ally of America, and because an enemy of America may take over, that's why the left, including Obama, are cheering for this uprising. And then when the Muslim Brotherhood takes over, Obama's going to be apologizing for America to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, there's a double edge to every sword. And on this one, we have a situation where in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we were looking for democracy. You know, the Bush freedom agenda, freedom forward agenda, was actually pushing for democracy and democratic change and a lifting of the Iron Curtain of dictatorship around the Middle East and the greater Middle East, all the way out from Morocco, all the way over to Indonesia, up into Azerbaijan and down into the GCC. So we were pushing for this under Bush. The problem is, because of the posture that we are taking on our foreign policy, because of the posture that we have, which does not push forward an establishment clause and a secular government agenda, in addition to the push for democracy, we are literally putting ourselves in the eye of the storm. I mean, we are literally allowing the popular uprisings of the Muslim world to be legitimized. That concept of legitimacy is key. The Obama administration has legitimized Hamas. They have legitimized Hezbollah. They have legitimized the IRGC. They have legitimized Syria's secret police. They've legitimized the Taliban. They've now legitimized the Muslim Brotherhood. They've legitimized the Wahhab. The process of legitimacy is what is at stake whenever you're dealing with political power in the Middle East. So since the United States government at this point is doing its best to help the Arab Spring topple regimes that used to be considered stabilizing forces but have always been nothing but strongmen, at this point we have a strange world that's about to take place. And that world is one in which Iran is the new superpower. And Iran is the one wrangling the will of the Muslim Brotherhood and all of the different agencies that are going against Israel. Because Iran is the only one who's ever demonstrated that it can defeat Israel through Hezbollah. So the Muslim world follows strength, power, and charisma. And right now, the person who's in the lead, the most dangerous person in the world, is Syed Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah. Yet the United States government is working deals to where we sell arms to Lebanon, whose army has been infiltrated fully and is controlled by Hezbollah. And now you have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, whose army has been fully infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood, and whose government is about to be possibly taken over by the Muslim Brotherhood in all probability. And
exactly.
you're going to have a storm in which Israel is in the middle. And now the only question is, why aren't the gates of of Gaza open between Egypt and Gaza? And what we're going to see in the next month is a number of flotillas going to arm the Hamas terrorists in Gaza. So that's what we're about to witness over the course of the next month. Does that make sense to you? I mean, is that what you're seeing as well?
Very much yes. That does make sense. I believe that you are right. But I mean, anyway, first of all, I think that Israel sometimes is too soft on the terrorists, but that's another area of discussion. But I mean, as for Egypt, I mean, I'm no fan of Mubarak, but I think that Egypt would have been better off under Mubarak. Whether the uprising started off as terroristic or not, I believe that it is terroristic because right now it is controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood. Democracy in the Arab and Muslim world would be great, but you don't achieve it by just having democratic institutions, because the very fact of the matter is, sure, the Muslim Brotherhood is willing to use the democratic institutions, but that's different from saying that they're democratic, because once they get power, they will impose Islamo-fascist tyranny. They will turn Egypt into an Islamo-fascist terrorist state the moment they have the chance.
I agree. Now, you have to realize that the Obama administration and its push for institutional change in the international community and at the democratic level and the state level for emerging nations is literally pushing for an evolutionary change, not a revolutionary change. So that's what they are, you know, piously doing on their elite rungs. But I tell you what, we are out of time today. I want everybody to know I appreciate y'all listening in today. Come back and see me next week. It's going to be a great show. We're going to de-romanticize this concept of Sharia-compliant finance. Guys, y'all have a great one. Come back and see us soon. Now, just to let you know, we can keep talking and going back and forth on this. We still have a little bit of time left after the break. I appreciate you calling in. It's a great call today. It's rare for somebody to be focused on the Muslim Brotherhood as hard. But let me ask you, what are you seeing in America as far as the response, as far as your friends are concerned?
What am I seeing? What am I seeing in America as a response to what's happening? As I said, with these before, I mean, I think it's a stupid circus that is, you know, that is basically saying that everybody who's pessimistic about what's happening is an apologist of Mubarak. I mean, I think that stupid circus, which is composed largely of liberals, in which I think it even includes President Obama, but that I think that circus is dangerous because basically telling us to put our blinders on while the Muslim Brotherhood is doing all they can to get more, to gobble more of the pie and to get what they want. And we see that the Muslim Brotherhood has facades. They have prostitutes like Mohammed al-Baradei, who states on the communist news network CNN that the Muslim Brotherhood supports a secular state and that they have no ties to extremism. And that's what Mohammed al-Baradei stated on CNN in his interview with Fareed Zakaria, who is a hypocrite, because Fareed Zakaria is so radically in favor of that Muslim Brotherhood mosque in Ground Zero that he even rejected a journalism award from the ADL. Why? Because the ADL said that building that mosque is not the smartest thing. But Fareed Zakaria one time casted Hezbollah, the Islamo-fascist Iranian proxy group which seeks to have a second Holocaust on the Jewish people, as a model of religious tolerance. I mean, of course, I mean, these Muslim Brotherhood prostitutes, when they go spread the Muslim Brotherhood tequila lies to the Western media, they have to go to the liberal mainstream media because they're unable to fool conservatives. There's no way they're going to successfully fool Glenn Beck or Sean Hannity. I mean, if they go try Pamela Geller from Atlas Shrugged, basically, there's no way she'll fall for it because she understands these Islamo-fascist tequila lies very well.
Well, I tell you what, you seem like you feel pretty strongly about it. You've obviously done a good deal of reading, but what you have to do right now, whenever you're paying attention to what's going on in America, in my estimation, is realize that a number of organizations are coming together on May 1st, and those organizations are led by ANSWR, and they will be having marches, May Day marches, around this country in every major city. And they will be calling the Jewish state the Zionist evil occupying force. They will be calling the Tea Party a bunch of KKK members. You're going to have the unions joining in with socialists. You're going to have all the people who are working to destroy America, literally on the streets of America, picketing. Not to mention around the world. So we're about to, over the course of the next 10 days, see a ratcheting up of propaganda. And that propaganda is what needs to be paid attention to. We need to analyze it. And instead of thinking in terms of what we already know as far as Taqiya and all the activities and Fareed Zakaria and all of those people who are natural apologists for this evil that we're seeing on a regular basis, what we need to do is reconsider our counter-influence narrative and the best way forward for us to defeat this enemy rather than worrying about what other people are saying to help the enemy. So It's a long battle, and I think we've got a long time. So take your time. You know, put your thoughts together in a little chat, an email to me, and send it over to ghjj@victoryinstitute.net, and we can keep going on this, okay? Sound like a plan?
Like you mean, like you're saying, send them through an email?
What now?
You're saying to send my thoughts through an email, or we can...
Yeah, I'm going to cut it off. I'm going to go ahead and cut off today because I've got a few things to do this evening. I only have a one-hour show scheduled, so pretty much we've lost everybody in the chat room and everybody who's paying attention. But if you could, you know, if you're interested or if anybody else is interested out there and, you know, getting in touch with me and talking about this, if you're interested in helping me research a number of subjects, you know, from Syria to Yemen to Bahrain, if you've got information that you'd like to help provide. I run a blog called the Manasseh Listening Post, and I'm trying to get that off the ground on a regular basis. So if you want to become a contributor or something along those lines, then we can actually work as allies instead of just bouncing ideas off of each other.
Right.
All right. So my email is ghjj@victoryinstitute.net, and you can get into contact with me anytime. And I generally check my email once a day, so I'll try my best to get back with you in a couple days.
All right. Yeah. Well, I may consider it. But I mean, so yeah.
Well, it's but tough. I mean, whenever you start taking an active role, it's different. There's a total difference between being an advocate and an activist, and that's where I come in. That's what I'm trying to teach the members of Act for America, the members of the Tea Party. I'm trying to teach the basic difference. And while we're in the process of defying and trying to defeat this enemy, we don't necessarily need to oppose when all we really need to do is expose. You know, we don't necessarily need to go against something when we can just expose it and let the facts speak for themselves, because we're looking for action on this, and the action might need to be taken way before saturation is reached on the market level. So in order to move forward in an active way, in a manner that is completely nonviolent and completely productive, the best way forward is to kind of saddle together and ring in the you know, all the stagecoaches, and start the process of figuring out where the best ammunition is, and as far as intellectual concepts and ideas. And then once we've got a team together, start the process of pushing forward an agenda that is rational yet radical, and an alternative to the evils that are facing us. I'm over at the United West as well, and you can read me at the Family Security Matters website as well. So do me a favor, check out what I've written on Libya so far, kind of bone up on that, and if you have any advice for me as far as Libya is concerned, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to send them over to me in an email, okay? Because I do keep into contact with people.
All right.
But Benjamin, you have a great one. I'm going to go ahead and cut it off today. I've got to run, okay?
Okay.
Have a good one now.
All right. All right. Bye.
All right, everybody. I'm going to go ahead and sign off for the evening. It is about 7 past the hour. Y'all come back and see me. Have a blessed one. Be easy.